Well, I would say we've had an interlude because we've been talking about Jacob and Esau, but we're still the main focus is still on Isaac's life. And as I said, there's not a lot of space devoted to him, but we'll get some here. So we start in chapter 26. There was a famine in the land. It says, besides the first famine that was in the days of Abraham. So it's making reference to something that was quite a long time ago. And Isaac went to Abimelech, the king of the Philistines, in Gerar. Remember, we mentioned Abimelech seems to be a title, and that's fairly common. This is not the same man that Abraham dealt with back in Genesis chapter 20. It's likely his son or grandson, but it is in the same place. He's a king of the Philistines in Gerar. Gerar is in Philistia, not in Egypt. The point is, because Isaac goes there, in verse 2, the Eternal appeared to him and said, don't go to Egypt, leave in the land. Live in the land, which I tell you. Dwell in the land. I'll be with you and bless you. I'll give you all these lands, which I swore and perforated the oath to you. God here seems to be formally passing the promises of Abraham on to Isaac. So God directly speaks to Isaac. And that's something most people can't say ever. And back then, but we will see, God spoke to Abraham. He would speak to Isaac. He'll speak to Jacob. It doesn't seem that he did as often to Isaac. And he says, stay here. He says, don't worry about the famine. I'll take care of you. And he mentions the blessings that he'd given to Abraham. Verse 4, I'll make your descendants multiply as the stars of heaven. I'll give to your descendants all these lands. And in your seed, all nations of the earth will be blessed. We can see again, it seems the promises of race and grace both passed to Isaac. And he mentions some of why. Verse 5, because Abraham obeyed my voice, kept my charge, my commandments, my statutes, and my laws. We like to look at this verse because this is long before Mount Sinai and God giving those tablets to Moses. But it seems to say before that particular codification, there were commandments, statutes, and laws in effect. And obeying them brings tremendous blessings. And I say that in answer to some people, and the Sabbath is the one that usually comes up. They'll say, well, the Sabbath was something that the Jews started at Mount Sinai, and after Jesus' crucifixion, it's done away. No, it didn't start at Mount Sinai, and it didn't end at Christ's crucifixion, which generally isn't a problem that we have in this room. I'm just pointing out this is a key scripture to help us make an argument against that. Now, verse 6, Isaac dwelt in Gerar. The men of the place asked about his wife. Oh boy, here we go again. And he said, she's my sister, because he was afraid to say she's my wife. He thought, lest the men of the place kill me. Why? Rebekah, she is beautiful to behold. Okay, so Isaac will work a similar deception as Abraham had, but he doesn't have the advantage of this being a half-truth. Rebekah and Isaac are not half-brothers and sisters. He's just flat-out lying for fear. And this tells us Rebekah must have been about as good-looking as her great-aunt Sarah was. So that's something, if barrenness runs in the family, hot looks also seem to run in the family, for what that's worth. Or at least Isaac, beauty's in the eye of the beholder. You could see Isaac thinking, man, she's such a hot babe, they're going to want to kill me. And the other guys are going, she's nothing special. I mean, I don't think that's the case, but, and there's an interesting contrast we'll see. He seems to think they're going to kill him, and we'll see, though, that they consider adultery to be a capital crime. So they have higher standards and values than Isaac is giving them credit for. And we'll see that as the story goes along, because he said this, it seems to pass around as they're visiting in that area. Verse 8, it came to pass when they'd been there a long time. We don't know how long a time it was, but Abimelech, the king of the Philistines, looked through a window, and there was Isaac showing endearment to his wife, which we always speculate, what is he doing? The old King James says he was sporting with his wife, which I always thought was funny. Like, they're playing catch or something. Showing endearment, maybe he's hugging and kissing her or something. And Abimelech says, look, obviously she's your wife. So how could you say she's my sister? And Isaac tells him honestly, I thought lest I die on account of her. So Abimelech says, what is this you've done to us? One of the people might soon have lain with your wife, and you would have brought guilt on us. So Abimelech charged all his people, he who touches this man or his wife will surely be put to death. And that's why that stands out. Death seems to have been the penalty for adultery among the Canaanites. And Actually, I'll give you a reference in Genesis 38, verse 24. Same year, 100-fold. That's a lot of return on an investment. So, and the man, that is Isaac, began to prosper and continued prospering until he became very prosperous. I love the way that's worded. I think he was doing well. He became very prosperous. And he had possessions of flocks, possessions of herds, a great number of servants, and the Philistines envied him. So, now the Philistines had stopped all the wells which his father's servants had dug in the days of Abraham his father. So, remember, he's down here traveling in this area, apparently. Whereas Abraham had spent a lot of time there, later on they moved probably up here somewhere else. And in the meantime, decades have gone by. They filled in those wells. Memories fade, you know. So it's not the same as it was decades ago. In verse 16, Abimelech said to Isaac, "Go away from us. You are much mightier than we." Now, it sounds like, "Get out of here. We can't stand you." But it seems more to be a case of, okay, let's reason together. You have too much stuff. Seems similar to the way it was between Abraham and Lot. Remember, Abraham and Lot both became very wealthy, had a lot of livestock, and they just had too much to keep them together, so they amicably separated. Now, Lot went a place that he shouldn't have gone and got into trouble, but this seems to happen here. Look, we're doing well, you're too wealthy, the land can't support all this livestock in one place, so we need to separate. So we know it's happened before, and it will happen again. I'm looking for, Jacob and Esau will later have a similar experience. They're both very wealthy and too wealthy with animals to stay together. So they do separate. Verse 18, Isaac dug again the wells of water that they dug in the days of Abraham. It's amazing, it's the days of Abraham. For us, it was just a couple chapters ago. But we've moved ahead in time quite a bit. He called them by the names which his father had called them. Isaac's servants dug in the valley, found a well of running water there. But the herdsmen of Gerar quarreled with Isaac's herdsmen, saying, "This water is ours." He named it Esek because they quarreled. What's interesting here is, so what did he do? He doesn't, "I'll show you whose this is, we're going to fight." No, he moves on and digs another well. They quarrel over that one. He calls his name Sitnah, and he moves and digs another one. And then he calls its name Rehoboth, for now the Lord has made room for us. Now, in a place where, well, a lot of the scholars talk about how arid it is. In the first week of school, I made the point that, yeah, it's semi-arid now, but it probably wasn't so much so then. But one thing we do want to note that hasn't changed is there are not many rivers in this area. I mean, you got the Nile over here, you got the Jordan is the main river in the Promised Land, and there aren't rivers much otherwise. So a steady source of water is something very valuable. So a reliable well is more valuable than we might think of around here. You know, I've lived in Ohio almost all my life, and you can't drive more than a couple miles without crossing a bridge. We got creeks and streams and rivers everywhere you look. Doesn't seem to be the case over there. I don't know if Dr. Britt, is that not a lot of rivers there, or... Okay, so that which, wow, so it seems to fit with what we're seeing here. One of the things I like to point out is Isaac is doing a very good example of what Jesus Christ described in the Sermon on the Mount, where he said, if someone strikes you on one cheek, turn the other cheek. Isaac is turning the other cheek, but in this case, he's digging another well. Let's not fight. I can go dig another well. He's being more generous than the Philistines are willing to be selfish and try to take away from him. It's not easy, but that's a principle in Christian life that, you know, Christ taught us to strive for. So we go on with that. In verse 26, Abimelech came to him from Gerar with Ahuzath, one of his friends, and Phicol, the commander of his army. Again, that seems to be a title because Phicol was with the other Abimelech earlier. I said, "What are you coming to me? Since you hate me, you sent me away." Well, they said, no, and we don't hate you. We're reading in here. It says, "We've seen that the Lord is with you, so now let there be an oath between us and you. Let us make a covenant that you'll do us no harm, since we haven't touched you, and we've done nothing to you but good, and we sent you away in peace." So they're sort of saying, no, we didn't mean this to be a hard feelings. We sent you away in peace. Let's make a covenant. Verse 30, he made them a feast. They ate and drank. And I could speculate, maybe this is another case of cutting the animals in half and walking through them. And I say maybe. It doesn't say that, but it seems to fit. So what they're doing is what their fathers had done about 90 years earlier. Because in reading, we said, it was only a couple chapters ago they did this. No, it was 90 years ago. Think, you know, what was going on here in Ohio back in, you know, let's see, it's 2017, so it would be 1927. 1927 seems like a long time ago, so if my great-grandparents made an oath with someone back then, it might seem worth renewing, doing something new now. The story of Abimelech and Isaac is similar enough to the story of Abraham and Isaac. You should know that there are Bible scholars who don't believe that the Bible is the inspired word of God, who teach that this was really one event happened, and this is two different versions of Hebrew folklore. So that's a widely held belief. I don't think that's true. I don't think it's just Hebrew folklore and two different versions were put into this after the Babylonian captivity, because we believe the word is inspired. God's word is. I think this does show us that children end up being a lot like their parents. And some of you, you've seen your parents, right? You're kind of like them in some ways. Yeah, me too. Matter of fact, I see Connor and I think, oh man. Matter of fact, I don't know how many times I've talked to Sue and said, it's amazing I survived to adulthood. I see the things he's doing, I think, I was just like that, and now I know how that can grate on the nerves of an adult. I didn't know when I was 7, but, you know, hey, I'm like, and I have a lot of the characteristics of my dad and my mom. So, yeah, it's not surprising Isaac is doing what Abraham did, you know, like father, like son. So they make this oath, things are good between them. Verse 31, they arose early, swore an oath with one another. Isaac sent them away. They departed in peace. And that very same day, Isaac's servants came and told him about the well they dug. We found water. So he named it Sheba. Therefore, the name of it is Beersheba to this day, or Beersheba. There's an account back in Genesis 21:31 of Abraham having a well named this. But as we read earlier, the Philistines had filled in those wells with dirt. So it seems like it's been rediscovered and given that name. And it's worth, I'll remind you, Beersheba is down here in the southern part of Israel. There's a town of Dan that would be established up here. You've probably already covered that in Judges. So you see a common phrase from Dan to Beersheba, meaning from north to south, the whole breadth of the country, because one's in the far north and one's in the far south. I think I've mentioned that before, but just throwing it in here again. Okay, and towards the end, now we're going to start moving back towards Esau and Jacob. When Esau was 40 years old, he took his wives, Judith, the daughter of Beeri the Hittite, Basemath, the daughter of Elon the Hittite, and they were a grief of mind to Isaac and Rebekah. Esau marries at the same age Isaac had, which shows a lot of time has passed in these last two chapters. You know, wasn't very long ago we were reading about Esau coming out red and hairy like a garment. Now he's 40 years old and he's got a couple wives. Isaac and Rebekah aren't happy about this, probably for a couple reasons. Remember how much time and effort went into their marriage. The servant sent out with 10 camels, and he has God work a miracle to show who Isaac should marry. Esau just runs out and marries the first Hittite he sees. Well, it's not exactly like that. Matter of fact, there's reason to speculate because Isaac is so wealthy and, you know, powerful, that these women might have been the daughters of tribal chieftains in the area. They were probably from families of significance, but they're also probably worshiping pagan gods. And their different ethnicity, that's not making the families very happy, or the parents aren't very happy. And we'll see Esau will take action later. Next we go into, though, a very important story. We've already had Jacob buy Esau's birthright. Now he's going to swindle a special blessing. And I'm sure most of you know this story pretty well, but we're still going to look at it. Chapter 27, verse 1. It came to pass when Isaac was old, his eyes were so dim that he could not see. And he was past 100. We don't know for sure how old he was, but remember, he was 60 when Esau was born. Esau was 40 when he got married, so we're at least Isaac being 100. I've read some accounts speculating that he might have been here 117. Some say maybe even as old as 137. So old. And he seems to think he's about to die. In verse 2 he says, "Behold, I'm old, I don't know the day of my death." Well, I know the day of his death, or at least the year, because I can turn ahead a few chapters. Isaac would live to be 180. I'm just saying this because I got to give this blessing because I might die soon. He's going to live at least 43 more years, maybe longer than that, depending on how old he actually is here. But his eyesight had declined. And I'll tell you, a year and a half, almost 2 years ago now, I developed a great appreciation for this story because I developed cataracts. And at first I didn't know what the world was going on, just things are getting blurry, you know, and my eyesight got to be like someone had put Vaseline in my eyes. And long and the short, I'll just mention, when I finally found out, I talked to an ophthalmologist, and he said, it's not normal to get cataracts at in your 50s, but it's not unheard of. But when you get them young, they usually develop very quickly. So what happened to me was normal in that sense. So I thought, I can understand someone walking in the room and you know someone's there, but you can't see who they are. It's that blurry. By the way, I got the surgery done and I can see fine, except I got to have these to read. So Isaac is kind of like this, oh, I'm going blind. I can't tell what's going on. It makes it easier to believe that Jacob could come in and say, I'm Esau, your son. Well, you sound kind of like Jacob, but let me feel your skin. You feel like Esau. And he just can't see well enough to know the difference. You know, like I said, I thoroughly believe that now. Anyways, he calls Esau and his older son, my son, here I am. And he says, I don't know when I'm going to die. Therefore, take your weapons, your quiver and your bow. Go out the field, hunt game. Make me savory food such as I love. Bring it that I may eat and my soul may bless you before I die. We could speculate, maybe he's also sick at the time. But, you know, he's not going to die soon. Why does he want this special meal? We don't know. Maybe just to get him in the mood or to celebrate the special occasion. Now, some scholars and readers have speculated that Isaac is trying to defy God's plan to give Jacob the birthright. You know, because, you know, before they were born, God said the younger is going to serve the older, or the elder is going to serve the younger. I said that backwards. Jacob bought the birthright. Well, let's keep in mind, we don't know if Isaac knows that Esau sold his birthright. It wouldn't be something I'd be bragging about. Or it could just be possible that Isaac considered the blessing to be separate from the birthright. Okay, yeah, Esau, you sold the birthright, but I can at least give you the foremost blessing. So it could be either one of those. I'm thinking there's some place earlier I overlooked something that's worth mentioning. Yeah, back in chapter 25, verse 28, where it says, Isaac loved Esau because he ate of his game, but Rebekah loved Jacob. Sorry, I skipped over that before, but parental favoritism. And I'm sure I won't be the first to tell you that's a bad idea. Even if you like one child more than the other, don't let them know. That's just a recipe for disaster, and we're going to see it take effect here. It's there. And Isaac wants to give Esau the special blessing. It says, Rebekah was listening here in chapter 27, verse 5. You know, so she knows Esau's going out to the field, so she gets Jacob. It says, I heard your father speak to Esau, your brother, saying, bring me game, savory food, that I may bless you. Okay, now, my son, Jacob, listen to what I'm going to tell you. Go to the flock. Bring me two choice kids of the goats. I'll make savory food for them, such as your father loves. So she's saying, I can make it taste exactly the way your dad wants, whether it's venison or goat, and you take it into him, and you in verse 10, take it to your father that he may eat, and he'll bless you before his death. Aha, you know, you're my favorite. I want you to get this special blessing. Again, not a good thing. I knew there was something else I wanted to mention. We know Rebekah probably did remember the prophecy that Jacob would have the superiority. I've got the reference was back in chapter 25, verse 23. So God had told her, hey, the elder is going to serve the younger. The younger is going to have the superiority. But maybe she didn't trust God to follow through quite so much. So she wants to take action on her own. So she's going to try to make sure you get this blessing. Okay, I've got one other thing I'll mention because I might forget it later, but the blessing that we're going to see in this chapter is not the most important blessing. They seem to talk about it as though it is, but in chapter 28, verses 3 and 4, you don't have to write this down, but chapter 28, verses 3 and 4 is where Isaac passes on the blessing of Abraham. And I'd say that is the more important blessing than you're going to be wealthy and you're going to have power and rule over your sons. The blessing of Abraham will be passed to Jacob at that point. And that's the one that we know from our perspective matters the most. But right now, they're all caught up in this. Back in chapter 27, verse 11, after Rebekah plans this, I was going to say this harebrained scheme. It seems like something that could be on I Love Lucy. It's so bizarre. You guys haven't seen I Love Lucy. I'm not sure what show would have. Oh, some of you have, yeah. Okay, so what does Jacob object to? Does Jacob say, no, it would be wrong to trick Dad. It would be wrong to swindle Esau out of the blessing. No, what he says is, oh, Esau is hairy and I'm smooth. What if Father feels me and I seem to be a deceiver and I bring a curse on myself? Jacob doesn't object to the wrongdoing. He's only afraid of getting caught, which is sad. And as a matter of fact, I'll comment later. One of the things we'll see in the story of Jacob is a development. He is going to mature spiritually a great deal during the decades that we see his life. But he's not there yet. And I was going to say he's a young man, but he's past 40. He should be there yet, but he's not. And I'll make a connection to something that appears later in the law. In Deuteronomy 27 and verse 18, Deuteronomy 27 verse 18, it says, "Cursed is he who makes the blind to wander off the road." Which means, basically, don't take advantage of a blind man because you can. And that's what they're proposing to do. Poor Isaac, his eyes are so blurry, he can't tell the difference between his two sons, and they're going to make him wander off the road. Well, later, God will write into the law of Israel, don't do that. Okay, that's Deuteronomy 27, 18. This is sort of a side issue, but it's nice to connect the dots here at times. We can give Jacob credit. Like I said, if he's not as religious and God-fearing as he's going to be, at least he does value this blessing, which shows he believes in God's power. He understands we worship the God, and I want to be blessed by that God. You know, he needs to develop a better relationship with him, but at least he wants the blessing. Getting back to this verse 13, his mother, Rebekah, said, "Well, let your curse be on me, my son, just obey my voice." We don't know if any curse ever actually came on Rebekah, at least directly. But let's consider the consequences. As we'll see, eventually Jacob is going to run for his life so Esau doesn't kill him. He'll be gone approximately 20 years, and many scholars studying this think that Rebekah died before Jacob ever came back. So in one sense, there was kind of a curse on her because of this. Being separated from your favorite son for the rest of your life, you know, that's not a pleasant thing to consider. And they brought it on themselves. Anyways, let's get into the story. You know, he went and got them. He got the goats, brought them to his mother. She made the savory food. Rebekah took the choice clothes of her order. So she gets in Esau's closet, gets clothes that's going to smell like Esau. And she puts the skins of the goats on the hands and on the smooth of Jacob's neck. Okay, so it's okay. Esau's hairy, you're not. And I don't think it was probably the goat's back where it's thick fur. But, you know, the underside where it's kind of hairy like a person could be, that's my guess. And he wraps it around here, you know, and around his neck. So when, you know, Isaac, all I see is a silhouette. Clothes smell like Esau. Feel his hands, feels hairy, you know, okay. You know, so they're planning this out. She makes the food just the way, you know, that Isaac loves and the way Esau knows how. Well, I could summarize. Verse 18, he went to his father and said, "My father." And he says, here I am. And Isaac said, "Well, who are you, my son?" "I'm Esau, your firstborn. I've done as you told. You know, sit up, eat my game, and bless me." And Isaac said, "How did you find it so quickly?" You know, he's suspicious right off the bat. "Well, because the Lord your God brought it to me." We could comment, he's saying the Lord your God. It's not yet the Lord my God. It will be later in Jacob's life, but he's not there yet. But that's a plausible answer. Isaac says, Jacob, come near, let I feel you, whether or not you're really my son Esau. You know, Isaac is suspicious of this. But he comes near, you know, and he felt him. And he said, well, the voice is Jacob's voice, but the hands are the hands of Esau. And he didn't recognize him because his hands were hairy. So he blessed him. He said, are you really my son Esau? And he said, I am. Okay, bald-faced lie. Yeah, I'm Esau, when he knows he's not. Okay, and these are pretty outrageous lies when you think about it, what they pulled off. But one thing we see, you see it in history and you see it in real life. Sometimes the most outrageous lies are the ones that people will believe the most. Because you know, who would lie about something like this? I imagine that Esau or Isaac might be thinking, well, Jacob wouldn't be dumb enough to try that. Yeah, he was. Or bold enough, I don't know. So he came, he ate the food, he drank the wine. Isaac says, come near and kiss me, my son. I'm sure it's a kiss on the cheek, not, you know. And he kisses him, he smells the smell of his clothing, and he starts waxing poetic in verse 27. Surely the smell of my son is like the smell of a field which the Lord has blessed. Therefore, now he starts in the actual blessing. God give you of the dew of heaven, a fatness of the earth, plenty of grain and wine. So he wants him to have plenty of food and riches, abundance of food and drink. Verse 29, let people serve you and nations bow down to you. So he wants him to have dominance over other nations. Be master over your brethren. Let your mother's sons come bow down to you. Speculate why he put sons in the plural when there's no record of them having any other children. And I don't know, often brethren can mean extended family. So that same term could refer to nephews and things like that. Could be something to do with grammar because it's poetry. But it says, cursed be everyone who curses you and blessed be him who blesses you. So he pronounces this great blessing on him. Abundance of possessions, dominance. God's promises had included some of this. God's promise to Abraham and then to Isaac included having many descendants and owning land and controlling the gates of your enemies. God's blessings didn't necessarily mention ruling over others or great wealth other than having a lot of land that could be derived from that. But we'll see, there's plenty of overlap. Anyways, as soon as Isaac had finished, Jacob had scarcely gone out, and then Esau comes in. And I'm guessing Jacob didn't hang around long. You know, let's sit around and chew the fat. Esau had made savory food, brought it to his father, and said, saying, let my father arise, eat of my son's game, that your soul may bless me. And as Isaac said, who are you? I'm your firstborn. And Isaac trembled exceedingly. The Hebrew here, scholars say, he trembled with a great trembling greatly. So he's really, you know, he's trembled with a great trembling greatly because he knows what just happened. And I'm sure by now it dawns on him. That was Jacob. He fooled me. And here's Esau. What am I going to do? He says, where is the one who hunted game and brought it? I ate of it and blessed him, and indeed he shall be blessed. This seems to show that God had granted him the power to convey a blessing, but not a power to rescind it. And I speculate just because that's what it seems to be saying. There's no record of him saying, get Jacob in here, I'm taking it back. Like, you can't take it back. I said earlier about the power of words. You can't unring a bell, you can't put the toothpaste back in the tube, you can't take back this blessing. At least apparently, that's what it seemed to be what Isaac thought, at least. Esau heard the words of his father and he cried with an exceeding great bitter cry. He said, Father, bless me, O my father. And he said, your brother has come and with deceit and taken away your blessing. And Esau said, isn't he rightly named Jacob, supplanter? He's supplanted me these two times, took away my birthright. And you could say he bought the birthright, but he swindled him, you know, and he coerced him in a bad situation. Now he's taken away my blessing. He said, haven't you reserved a blessing for me? Isaac answered, oh, I've made him your master, and all his brethren I've given to him as servants. With grain and wine I've sustained him. What am I going to do now for you? And Esau says, Esau had a good point. Do you only have one blessing? Bless me, O my father. Esau lifted up his voice and wept. Yeah, that's kind of pitiful. You might make note of Hebrews 12:17 here. Hebrews 12:17, because there's It makes note, Esau found no place for repentance, though he sought it with tears. So yeah, he's literally weeping and having tears, wanting to undo this situation. And there's no room. It can't be done, it seems. Now, Isaac does pronounce a blessing on him that's somewhat inferior, but it's not nothing. He said, "Your dwelling shall be in the fatness of the earth and of the dew of the heaven above. By your sword you shall live. You'll serve your brother, and it'll come to pass when you become restless, you'll break his yoke from your neck." And that's somewhat true. I mean, Jacob would have a superiority, but especially during their lives, Esau has the greater military power and perhaps wealth, and Jacob's scared to death of him, as we're going to see as the story progresses. And verse 41, it says, Esau hated Jacob because of the blessing which his father blessed him. So Esau is angry enough to kill his brother. As I said, Esau becomes rather warlike and has this power. And it does seem from what we see historically and in the Bible that the nation descended from him, the Edomites, would be rather warlike and somewhat nomadic. They would establish a nation down in this area, but parts of them would travel and they would be quick to fight, that type of thing. So I'm not surprised that he's angry enough to want to kill his brother in this case. And who can get more angry at someone than their own brother? I mean, those of you who have siblings have probably felt that way one time or another, and you also love your siblings. I'm sure my sister wanted to kill me probably more than once. Especially when we were young. We got along great ever since maturity. Oh, well, he does also say, the days of mourning for my father are at hand, then I'll kill him. So out of deference to Isaac, so I'm not going to kill him while Dad is still alive, but Dad's not going to live much longer. So not only did Isaac think he'd die soon, everyone else did. As I mentioned, Isaac's going to live, you know, maybe 40 more years. There's plenty of time left, but he thinks it'll be soon. Word gets to Rebekah. You know, words of Esau reach Rebekah. She called Jacob, her younger son. Esau comforts himself by intending to kill you. That's not good news. Now therefore, my son, obey my voice, flee to my brother Laban in Haran. Stay with him a few days till your brother's fury turns away. Until your brother's anger turns away and he forgets what you've done to him, then I'll send to you and bring you from there. Why should I be bereaved of you both in one day? Yeah, not a few days. As I said, it's going to end up being 20 years. The bereaved of both of them in one day seems to be referring to the fact that if Esau murdered Jacob, then he could be liable to be executed for committing murder. And then, so then she loses them both in one day. And by the way, this is reflected, that potentiality is reflected in what turns out to be a fictional story that's presented to King David. It's in 1 Samuel chapter 14, where, and it's the case where Joab is trying to reconcile Absalom with David, and he sends a woman telling the story, you know, my two sons were, you know, fought and one killed the other, so now they want to execute the murderer and I'm going to lose both of my sons. You know, so Rebekah doesn't want that to happen, so she got to prevent the murder in the first place. So go stay with my brother Laban. It'll be just be a few days. Now I'll make note, some scholars I've studied say that verse 46 might really be best if it were the start of chapter 28. I'm not sure if it makes much difference. The story flow continues because Rebekah said to Isaac, so she said one thing to Jacob, she's going to give Isaac a different reason for Jacob to flee. So the idea is maybe Isaac doesn't know that Esau wants to kill Jacob. But she says, I'm weary of my life because of the daughters of Heth. That's another way of saying the Hittite women. If Jacob takes a wife from the daughters of Heth, like those who are the daughters of the land, what good will my life be to me? And it's funny, this sounds like the stereotypical Jewish woman you might hear in TV or something like that. What good is my life? But, you know, she's saying, look, Esau married these Hittite women. I want Jacob to marry one of our type, you know, one of our religion. And it continues in verse 28. So Isaac called Jacob, blessed him and charged him and said, you're not going to take a wife of the daughters of Canaan. Arise, go to Padan Aram, to the house of Bethuel, your mother's father. It's the house of him. As we said, we don't think that Bethuel is still alive. Take yourself a wife from there of the daughters of Laban, your mother's brother. And here, as I mentioned, is where he passes on the blessing of Abraham. May God Almighty bless you and make you fruitful and multiply. May you be an assembly of peoples and give you the blessing of Abraham to you and your descendants, that you may inherit the land in which you're a stranger, which God gave Abraham. So again, this is a very important blessing that he wants to pass on. So, and he's going to leave. In verse 5, Isaac sent away Jacob. He went to Padan Aram to Laban, the son of Bethuel, the Syrian. Before we continue with that, I'll comment, you know, the story of Jacob and Esau, you know, there's a good demonstration of that principle of what you sow, you shall surely weep. Not weep, reap. You'll sow what you reap. Or the common phrase, what goes around comes around. Okay, yeah, Jacob swindled his brother and tricked him and his father. Guess what? Very soon, Jacob is going to be swindled and fooled by his uncle Laban. Later on in life, he's going to be fooled by most of his sons who make him think his favorite son Joseph is dead when really they sold him into slavery. So Jacob's going to have it come back on him. And you kind of feel sorry for him, but then you think, well, it didn't have to be this way. Okay, so Isaac commands Jacob to go take a wife from among his cousins, which is something we think is really creepy today, but wasn't so uncommon back then. I think it's interesting, the comparison. You know, not long ago, we were seeing Abraham send a servant to get a wife for Isaac, but he said, don't let Isaac go there. You know, the servant said, what if she won't come? Should I take Isaac there? No, he's got to stay here. But now Isaac is sending Jacob away. So I think it's an interesting difference. I think he knows Jacob is going to come back, and Jacob has to know that. Galatians 3 and verse 14, where Paul is describing some of this, shows that although in passing on the blessing of Abraham, it seems here Isaac is referring to the promise of race. In Galatians 3:14, Paul shows that the blessing would include the promise of grace, as we say, and that the Savior, Jesus Christ, would be descended from Jacob. So I just want to mention that. You could say, well, what happened to that part of it? Well, maybe it was implied or mentioned later, but it does pass through there. And Jacob is going to take off. Yeah, we'll get to it later. I'll just mention, as I'm talking about the contrast between Isaac and Jacob, when the servant went to get a wife for Isaac, he took 10 camel loads of stuff. Jacob goes carrying only what he's got on his back. Later he says he came with a staff, he's probably got a backpack or something with some food supplies and a canteen, and that's it. So rather different circumstances. Now, before we pick up the story of Jacob, we'll see what Esau thinks about this. Esau saw that Isaac blessed Jacob and sent him away to get a wife, that Jacob obeyed. So in verse 8, Esau saw that the daughters of Canaan didn't please his father Isaac. So he went to Ishmael and took Mahalath, the daughter of Ishmael, Abraham's son. So he's going to marry one of his cousins, the sister of Nebajoth, to be his wife in addition to the other wives. So Esau seems to think he can get back into his parents' favor by marrying a wife of their ethnicity, at least similar ethnicity. And I've got the note, we don't know when it was that Ishmael and his descendants would turn away from worshiping the true God to paganism, but the story of the Bible later indicates that surely they did. Whether it was Ishmael personally or only his sons or grandsons or great-grandsons, later they're not worshiping the true God. So, you know, we're not sure if that's already happened yet, but if so, it would lend support, because this still isn't satisfying to the parents, and maybe not to God, which I tie to the idea that God's concern is more that he doesn't want interreligious marriage more than he doesn't want interracial marriage. And I make that point a number of times in class because we stressed it so strongly the other way in decades past. So not that the church is ever going to say, yeah, we want you to marry different races and that's the best thing to do. We don't teach that, but we don't teach that it's a sin to do so. So the scriptures have to be interpreted one way or the other. It's either they're showing that it's a sin to marry someone of a different race, or it's a sin to marry someone of a different religion. You know, it doesn't seem to be that it's all both. I'm not sure if I said that as clearly as I meant to, but it'll come up again later, so it's not the main point here. It shows it's a concern back then. To come back to Jacob, of course, he's on his way. Verse 10, Jacob went out from Beersheba towards the north to Haran. He came to a certain place and stayed there all night because the sun had set, so he's setting up camp, took one of the stones and put it at his head and lay down to sleep. I'm glad here it says at his head. The old King James said he used it for a pillow. I don't know anybody that uses a rock for a pillow. And where he is, we'll find out later, is called Bethel. So he'd left Beersheba, and Bethel is, now I saw it on the map earlier. Yeah, it's up here. So it's, you know, up nearer to what will be Jerusalem. So he's traveled a good little ways, and he had a dream. He dreamed, and behold, a ladder was set up on the earth. Its top reached to heaven. And by the way, the ladder, the Hebrew phrase, seems would be better interpreted stairway. So don't think of a ladder. You think of more of like a stairway, the word implies. But its top reached to heaven, and the angels of God were ascending and descending upon it. And behold, the Eternal stood above and said, I am the Lord God Abraham, your father, the Lord God of Abraham, your father, and the God of Isaac. The land on which you lie I will give to you and your descendants. Also your descendants shall be as the dust of the earth. You'll spread abroad to the west and the east, the north and the south. And in you and in your seed all the families of the earth will be blessed. Here God specifically is speaking to Jacob, and he does confer the promise of race and grace, as we say. And that's just a catchphrase. But yeah, you're going to have the land, a lot of descendants, and in you all nations will be blessed, which happens through the sacrifice of Jesus Christ. This might be God's way of saying, okay, Jacob, you're getting these. We need to get acquainted. This seems to be the first time that God speaks directly to Jacob. He had spoken to Isaac. He had spoken to Abraham. And he's going to show that he intervenes in human affairs. He's a God of power and one who is involved and active. And we can see also, Jacob doesn't have to scheme to get these blessings. God promises them, he'll fulfill them. There's an interesting commonality in the phrase here. I'll just point out, and people that have a lot of time on their hands spend a lot of time debating this, which I won't do, but in John 1 and verse 51, Jesus said, he used the phrase, hereafter you'll see angels ascending and descending on the Son of Man, meaning himself. And we see the similarity here. Jacob had this vision of angels ascending and descending the stairway. And so it seems almost as the stone or that location and Jesus are playing a similar role. And that ties into the fact that Jesus is often called the stone. There's a number of scriptures, and I thought I had a bunch of them written down. Isaiah 8, verse 14, Daniel 2, 34. Let me just give you a sampling. Matthew 21, verse 42, and others where the stone is a title that's given to Jesus Christ. And we see here a stone of significance that I'm sure is symbolic. It's not that this rock had some magic power or that God lived in the rock, but Jesus Christ's role of intervening with man and going, you know, being in heaven and then coming to earth and going back, we see a significance there. So we have this great vision. Verse 15, behold, I'm with you. I'll keep you wherever you go. I'll bring you back to this land. I won't leave you till I've done what I've spoken. So it's worth noting these great promises, the blessing of Abraham and Isaac, but God also says, and also, I'll take care of you. You know, which a lot of people say, yeah, what good are all these blessings if I get mugged and beat up or sick and die? And now what we're seeing next seems to indicate Jacob still had a pretty limited view of God. Jacob arose from his sleep, but God is in this place, and I didn't even know it. He was afraid. How awesome is this place? This is none other than the house of God, and this is the gate of heaven. So I said, Jacob's thinking, God lives here. He needs to realize God doesn't have to live in a particular place. God, you know, can be wherever he wants. So Jacob will get there. But for now, he rises in the morning, he wants to have a memorial. So he took the stone that he put at his head, set it up as a pillar, and poured oil on top of it. So that's an anointing he does. And he called the name of the place Bethel, which means house of God. The name of the city had been Luz previously. And this is one of those references that might have been Moses writing this in, you know, hundreds of years later to make the distinction. Jacob made a vow saying, if God will be with me and keep me in the way that I'm going and give me bread to eat, clothing to put on, so I come back to my father's house, then the Lord will be my God. I'll note, I've read a number of sources that say that this might have been better translated to say, since God will be with me, or because God is making me these promises, then he'll be my God and I'll give him a tenth, which seems a little less materialistic than it would be. Still, it's evident, as I said, that Jacob has a limited, fairly materialistic view of God. Hey, he's going to give me all these blessings, that's why I'll tithe. You know, later on it'll go on to other things. We should note, of course, he says, this pillar shall be God's house. There is legends and traditions about this stone. It becomes known as the stone of destiny, or the stone of scone, which I'm not sure if that's like scone and what, tea and scones, or, but tradition says that, well, I'll say what happens now in Britain when they crown a new monarch, they sit on a chair that has a stone built into it. You can see it was in Westminster Abbey for years and years, and a couple decades ago they moved it back up to Scotland. And it had been in Scotland, it had been in Ireland before that, and tradition says it was this very stone. And these traditions say it got up there in the first place because Jeremiah took it with him along with the daughters of King Zedekiah, and we'll discuss that later. I think I mentioned it briefly. And so this stone has been there, been in this family all along. I learned when I visited Ireland some years ago that you've probably heard of the Blarney Stone that's in the Castle Blarney. They say it's a chip off of this particular stone. And is that true? I don't know. You know, is it true that this stone, the stone of destiny on which the monarchs are crowned, is the one Jacob slept on or near? We don't know. It doesn't have to be true for the Bible to be true, but there's enough tradition there and credence to it that it's worth at least, you know, knowing about and thinking it could be true. You know, I think that's kind of, you know, amazing and interesting. I'll mention I came across one version of the tradition, which I don't think is true, but one version says Jacob not only did that, but then he packed it up and took it with him. And he carried it with him all of his life, and that later it went down to Egypt. And they even say that, you know, when Moses struck the rock to get water, that it was that rock. And personally, I think that's a stretch. Most people say, no, that's not the case. And, you know, that's a not widely held tradition. But it's worth you knowing there are some out here that will make that case. And last thing I'll just mention, we see another reference to tithing, which reminds us that that's, you know, it's a principle that seems to have existed well before the Levitical law that's given to Moses. You know, Abraham tithed to Melchizedek, Jacob promises to tithe to God. Later on, it's built into the law of Israel, and we follow it today, not just for that reason, but because it seems to be a principle that God teaches. Okay, questions, comments? I threw a lot there, but I wanted to get to the end of that, and on Monday we'll pick up with chapter 29. Oh.